Before we begin this week's episode, I want to share a book I recently finished by Kensington Publishing. American Fly Girl by Susan Tate Ankeny chronicles the amazing true story of Hazel Ying Lee, an unrecognized pioneer and unsung World War II hero who fought for a country that discriminated against her gender, race, and ambition. Inspired by Amelia Earhart and America's fledgling aviation industry, Hazel was the first Chinese-American woman in U.S. history to earn a pilot's license and fly for the military as a member of the Women's Air Force Service Pilots, or WASPs. Now, I'd heard of the WASPs, but really knew nothing about them or their incredible stories until reading this book. American Fly Girl, the true story of Hazel Ying Lee, who followed her dreams against all the odds and became an American hero, is written by Susan Tate Ankeny and goes on sale April 23rd, 2024, wherever fine books are sold. Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Fighter Pilot Podcast. On this episode, we are resuming our discussion on the F-4 Phantom II, and we will be doing that with Tiger and Fingers. But right now, we got Sunshine on the line, and what'd you think of the last episode, bud?
Dude, loved it. It's stunning, though. So the Princeton grad there, Tiger, right? 3,000 F-4 hours?
And just in the F-4, and then, oh, by the way, he went on to fly the F-14.
Yeah, holy cow, and 35 years of active and reserve service, and then, yeah, and then Fingers with 2,000 hours right in the backseat of the F-4, though, so just another amazing story, and I can't wait for the listeners to hear the story of how he got his call sign, Fingers.
Well, it's not a great story, but now that it's over, we can all laugh about it, and he's certainly learned how to deal with it.
Great attitude, yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And on that note, Sunshine, I just want to comment that when I interview someone, I usually try to do just a little bit of editing to make everyone sound their best. Mm-hmm. So for example, if someone says four 10 times, like I just did on purpose, I cut about six of those out and I just make it, you know, it's like putting makeup on. You're already beautiful, but then you're more beautiful with makeup. So, but the point I'm trying to get to eventually here is that when it comes time for Fingers to tell his story of the call sign and his imprisonment leading up to that, I don't do any editing. I felt like I would be doing a disservice to him and the story. And so if there are longer than normal pauses in your mind, that's how he normally speaks. And I didn't cut and pull those together. I just thought I owed that him dignity of just letting him tell that story. What do you think?
Yeah, I think kind of preserving that sanctity of that, such a amazing story. You know what I'm saying? Pretty crazy. So I think perfect to leave unedited. So absolutely.
Okay. Well, then why don't we just get to it?
All right.
Fingers in the back seat. What, did you have side controllers for the Rio, or was there another set of flight controls, or was it interchangeable? Like in the F-18 D and F, they can either configure it for a WISO in that case, or an instructor pilot. What did the back seat of an F-4 have?
Nothing. No controls.
No flight controls at all.
You had the radar control and the no controls for flying the airplane. Oh, no, it was strictly. Well, that's all the Navy Phantoms and Marines. The Air Force, they build them with sticks in the back seat, too.
There was a time they actually put pilots in the back instead of dedicated radios.
My flight lead, my second tour, was an exchange Air Force pilot, and he had had a whole first tour in the back seat of an F-4 in the Air Force.
Oh, wow.
And then he goes back to shore duty somewhere, and then he came back to the Navy, and now he gets to fly in the front seat in another combat tour on the ship.
No kidding. Okay, that's crazy.
We had no controls or anything back
then. Well, I know the F-14 didn't either. So, yeah. John Ed, when you went through training, your first flight was essentially a solo. I mean, I'm sure there was a pilot in the back, but he couldn't reach controls or anything?
That's correct.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, there were no two-seater controls in the F-14. Uh-huh. The F-4,
Models had a stick in the back.
Okay. And there were some of those in the training commands.
And they were in the training command, but I think only a handful, I mean, maybe 450 or 60 of them or something like that.
All right. Now, we were talking still about strengths. How about any weaknesses? Nobody ever likes to admit weaknesses of their baby on these interviews. But one is fairly obvious. Early F4s were pretty smoky. And the problem with smoky engines is it makes it relatively easy to gain an initial tally and then keep it in the visual arena. What else would you be willing? I mean, they fixed that. As did they?
Yeah, they fixed it after the war.
After the war.
Unfortunately.
All right.
Yeah, the smokeless engine did not come until after Vietnam was over.
Sure. So for the folks on the ground, it's good for them, too, if you're smoking, because they can see you.
You'd have to go into burner, min burner, to get rid of that smoke when you're going in,
right,
which is doing what? It's eating up your gas.
Right.
So, you know, there's a trade-off there.
What was the smoke, by the way? And this is where I wish Sunshine was here. I'm sure he could tell me, but it's just unburned particulate from the fuels, basically?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they figured out a way, finally, to chemically fix that, or different JP or something. All right. Any other?
I think the afterburner would dissipate the smoke. So as Jack said, that was a common tactic. On the run in, you'd go to min burner, and the smoke would disappear.
Yeah.
But you're now, you know,
right,
15 miles out of the merge, and you're in min burner. So.
Mm-hmm. Which means you got to manage your speed, because if you show up too fast, that's actually a liability and not an asset.
I think that the min burner concept worked. Only for the visual part. The rest of the advantages were disadvantages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
And its turning radius in horizontal too was a
an other
for the F4 too. That's why our fight was vertical. You
right.
Know, go up.
Which didn't really come back to the F4 until Top Gun came along, right?
That's right.
As I read it. Okay.
Because
also,
we could with those engines. I mean, you could out climb your opponent and then turn back around. Yeah.
Right.
So.
All right.
So the horizontal turning, I think, was a disadvantage of it, too.
Tiger, were you an LSO by any chance?
I was not.
Okay. Because I heard anecdotally that they could use the smoke as an idea of what the pilot was doing, at least in the daytime.
Yeah. Wouldn't surprise me at all.
No, yeah.
Because you use the whole aircraft anyway, and your ears and everything.
So. I think from my perspective, one of the biggest disadvantage was the lack of fuel. Mm-hmm. I know that an hour 45 cycle on the ship, you're pressed, especially if you're coming back from not an alpha strike, but any other mission that was on a cycle, you were strapped. You were usually trick or treat at the ball. I mean, your first pass was you better get aboard or you're going to have to go tank.
1.5.
Because, you didn't have enough gas to, and I flew the F-14 and it was like, gosh, we've got twice the amount of gas in an engine that burns half the amount that the Phantom did almost. And so it was like no big deal. Mm. But in the Phantom, you were always on the edge for fuel.
And in order to get more gas, you'd have to carry the wing tanks or the center line.
Right.
I mean, and the wing tanks, those were more drag and.
But was that a standard configuration? And the F-18 deployed, you almost never took the tanks off, maybe for an air power demonstration, but otherwise you had at least two, sometimes three.
Two squadrons I was in, VF-21, 161, our standard configuration was a centerline tank and, two Sparrows and four Sidewinders for a fighter.
And what did the F-4 carry internally for fuel?
13,400 pounds internally, and centerline 17,000.
Yeah.
But my squadron, the crews before, carried three tanks, the whole cruise. And they finally said, why are we carrying three tanks? So they dropped the wing tanks, and they found out that the extra weight and fuel burn carrying those tanks didn't help you that much.
It was a wash.
So the centerline was the configuration of the standard configuration. Yeah.
Tiger, when was your last flight in an F-4?
In F-4, November of 1984.
So that's, 30 some odd years ago?
Yeah.
You rattled off those fuel numbers like you just hopped out of the thing this morning.
I love the airplane. And I don't know, lots of things I've forgotten, but some things
stick with you. Yeah.
You don't have careers like you gentlemen had and not walk away different. I mean, it's just, especially Fingers with your story here we're about to get to, but I asked you the fuel and boom, you rattled it right off. That's awesome.
I said, fuel was a concern.
For sure.
And they always had a nag in the back seat asking you how much fuel we got. So that was another advantage.
Of the multi-crew concept. Absolutely.
It was kind of like flying with your wife. You always somebody to nag you all the time. Right?
Yeah.
Was that like a best practice for a Rio is nag? Oh, dear me. All right. Well, where would the listener who maybe doesn't know or have lived the life that we led, obviously we know the F-4 pretty well, but for the casual observer, where would they have seen the F-4 either in, everyday life or in Hollywood? What notoriety is the
Phantom? Everyday life would be the Blue Angels and the Thunderbirds a few years ago when back they both were flying. That was in the
70s. In the 60s and 70s.
69 to 74, I believe it was. Yeah. And they were that was the only time both teams flew the exact same airplane, kind of airplane, right?
Yeah.
Maybe different models, but they both flew the F-4.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think we talked about this earlier. There's a movie, great movie, but The Great Santini. That was the story of a Marine F-4 pilot. Yeah. I'm trying to think where else.
Well, there are a lot of places around the country. They're on display at museums or up on posts. And
Like the one on the Midway you told us about earlier.
There are actually two on the Midway.
Oh.
One of them is configured as a bomber mode, and it's got the bombs on it to show you what it could carry in bombs. And then the one that I like to call the Midway Phantom was the one that I talked about earlier that we got down there, and it's painted up on one side with the VF-21 colors as that they had in 1965 when the first two MiGs of the war were shot down.
Okay.
And then on the starboard side is painted up in 161 colors, which when the last MiG of the war was shot down in
So the first
January,
and the last.
First and last. So that represents the beginning and the end of the air war in Vietnam.
Okay.
Both by Phantoms flying off USS Midway.
Okay.
So it's kind of historic.
Sure. Well, you were involved with a shoot down, were you not, Fingers?
Yeah.
When was that?
Well, the fun part one, the thrill of victory, so to speak, that was 23 May 1972.
Okay, well, that's getting towards the end of the war. There's less than a year left before the folks came home.
We had a section of Phantoms, and we were on a MGCAP mission going up to place ourselves between Kep and Haiphong, where the Alpha Strike was going in.
Uh-huh.
And as soon as we crossed the beach up there, we got a call from our controller out on the on Red Crown, and gave us a vector. Said Rock River, 100 is our call sign.
Rock River's your call sign, okay.
Rock River was Squadron's call sign. And we were flying bird number 100, Rock River 100. Your vector is 270, 30-some miles, something like that. And you have bandits. So we started going. And my pilot, Muggs McEwen, he's a whole story in himself.
Yeah, we can talk a lot about that.
God rest his soul. He's gone now. But so we take in a vector, and he said to me, he said, Jack, he said, did he say bandits? I said, I think so. He said, go on and ask him. I said, did you say bandits? Because bandit meant it's a confirmed MiG. You know, we used to get, you'd had a bogey or something like that. But if they say bandit, it was.
Right, enemy.
So I called back to the Red Crown. I said, did you say bandit? He said, Roger, bandit. He said, you're cleared to arm, cleared to fire.
Wow.
And so we're going in with a clear to fire.
Hmm. Now, this was what the F-4 was designed to do.
Perfect. That's right.
Okay.
So we're going over, and of course, we're in the B. And we
talked about what it doesn't like over land.
It doesn't like over land. So it all the ground return and everything like that was hard as hell to sort out any contacts. And halfway into the merge, our wingman, Rookie Rab and Ken Crandall comes up and said, hey, I'm lead nose. I just lost my radar. So we got one radar and two airplanes, and we're going in there. So I'm searching, and I can't find anything. And finally, we're getting closer, and I thought I had a contact, and I tried to lock it up. It wouldn't lock. But by that time, we were, I don't know, 6 or 7 miles, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Mug says, tally-ho, on the nose. What he saw were two MiG-19s coming through.
Okay.
And, of course, the closure rate was pretty quick, and they went right between us. We were in combat spread.
So a mile and a half apart.
A mile and a half. And MiG-19s went screaming through, and Muggs said, cross turn, we'll go high, you go low. We crossed turn right there, and thinking that, we had our fangs out, because two of our shipmates had just shot down two MiG-19s a week before in that same area. So we thought, oh, boy, we're going to get us some MiG-19s. Well, we screwed up. We didn't clear behind them like we should have.
Ah.
And there were four MiG-17s in trail behind them.
Red Crown didn't tell you this?
No, they didn't see them because they were low, and they didn't tell us that. We thought we were just going against two, and whether Red Crown ever knew it or not, I don't know. But so their plan, which I confirmed when we went over to Vietnam in 2016 and met one of those pilots in person, their plan was that it was a trap. 19s were the bait, and we were supposed to turn on them, which we did. And then they were going to be behind us and shoot us down.
Right.
But they had neglected to leave enough nose-to-tail separation between the two elements. And instead of breaking between the two of them, we broke into the formation of the four MiG-17s.
Oh, wow.
So that's when the excrement hit the air conditioning system, as they say. And
all right.
So we started turning, and Muggs started turning on one of the 17s, and about that time, one of the 19s had come back through the fight, so he thought that was a better one, and he was going to cough out that and get on the 19. And by this time, I'm out of the cockpit. I mean, radar's, you
right.
know, I'm just checking.
You're in a knife fight now with a group of people.
In a phone booth. Mm. So we're screaming, and I look back, and I see one at 8 o'clock, and he's starting to saddle in on us like this, and it makes 17. And you can't see my hands, folks, but I'm shooting my watch down right now. But anyway, he's starting to close in on us and starting to shoot. And I said, Muggs, 8 o'clock, track and shoot and do some of that pilot stuff. And he pulled off the 19, looked back, and he said, holy expletive. And the maneuvering that airplane so violently to break the track that we actually departed the airplane.
Oh.
And it did a backflip.
Ooh.
Complete backflip. And I'm fighting back there trying to, what in the hell are you doing up there? I'm trying to keep my eye on this guy back here, and we're going around, and Muggs pulled out of it. He regained the control, pulled out of it, and lo and behold, that 17 was up in front of us. And we took a shot at him, but we were out of zone or whatever, and didn't get it. So we turned, and we got him engaged with a couple more. We got another shot on another one, and he defeated the missile again, too. So we're kind of feeling sorry for ourselves. You know, boy, here we've blown two shots and haven't got anybody. And that time, this time, I'm looking back at 4 o'clock, and another 17 is tracking us, and he's just coming up on us. And I see the big old orange 37 millimeters start coming at us.
Yikes.
And I called it out to Muggs, and he looked back and let out another expletive of some kind.
Comrade.
And started turning hard into him to break the tracking solution. When he did that, the MiG-17 just pulled up, and all we saw was his nose, the underside of his nose. Muggs had been part of the exploitation program,
have drill.
And he had actually flown one of the 17.
Really?
So when he saw that, he immediately realized that guy couldn't see us because you couldn't see over that nose.
Sure.
So he came out, he just went to idle, went full stick forward, and we just zero-G'd. And he kept turning, and we're zero-G'ing away from him until pretty soon he starts wiggling his wing, looking for us. By that time, we had built enough separation. Muggs came back around, pulled up behind him like that, and we got a good tone, and that was our first kill.
No kidding.
And so we looked across the circle. In the meantime, while I'm talking about all this, what we're doing, our little dance up there, Rookie and Ken had gone low, and they couldn't get, they had a MiG-17 or two tracking them. They were actually flying at treetop level trying to shake these guys. And we saw what was going on across the circle after we got our kill. And Hugs said, drag him east, west, whatever it was. And so he kept dragging him over, and we came, did a barrel roll behind, and got behind the other MiG and shot him off Rookie and Ken's tail. And that was our second kill of the day. And by that time, we were talking about fuel earlier, right?
Right.
We were kind of sucking on fuel. So we joined up and got the hell out of Dodge and got out and had a tanker waiting for us. We tanked on, came back and landed. And so that was our thrill of victory.
Wow. What were the missiles employed?
Sidewinders.
Sidewinders, yeah. Okay. Yeah. And the time between the first and the second, I mean, seconds, 30 seconds, maybe?
Oh, yeah. The whole fight probably didn't last 10 minutes. I mean, it was, I mean, at those speeds, I would say probably 10, 12, maximum 15 minutes. I don't even think it lasts that long.
I wouldn't.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if it was that long, yeah.
No. Mm. Because, you know, it happens so quickly.
Right.
And so we came back and landed, and that's when I thought, oh, hell, we just been through a big dogfight, and Muggs come back, and, of course, he's going to, okay, all right, we're going to do a shit-hot flyby. And he tells Rookie, okay, you go starboard side, I'm going on port side, and we're going to go in, and we're going down, and we're flying along, and the speed of heat, and I'm looked out like that, and I'm looking at the port side of the ship's flight deck.
Right at eye level?
At canopy level. And I said, Muggs, if you kill us here, I'm never going to speak to you. But we went up, popped up, did a whirly do, and came back and landed. Mm. And went to the ready room to tell everybody how great we were. But that was a pretty exciting day.
I guess. Well, that is a pretty exciting sea story. Thank you very much. Let me ask you this. If the radar had cooperated, was your training and mindset such that had you had a lock at 10 or 12 or more miles, you would have fired a Sparrow?
Because we had cleared a fire. Right. They were said Badger.
Which is very unusual.
Yeah.
Right.
Very
unusual. Right. Mm-hmm. That was my point.
But we just could not. As a matter of fact, we had the what do you call it?
Pilot lock on.
Pilot lock on capability too. And I couldn't get a lock as far out. And as we got closer, Mokes tried that too, and it still wouldn't lock on. Mm. So, yeah, if we didn't gotten a good lock on, we'd have let the Sparrow go.
Sure.
But, as you know, at the closure rates you're talking about, you know, the opportunity is very, very narrow.
And for where you were ground threats not an issue? And was that because of either where you were or because obviously there was MiGs there too?
Well, the whole fight actually occurred damn near right over Kep Airfield.
Which is where the AAA training
was. Would be like having a dogfight over Miramar. And matter of fact, remember that one MiG-17 pilot that said he was on watch?
He's on the ground watching the whole thing.
And he said he was on the ground. He watched the whole fight.
Okay.
So, I mean, so it was interesting.
So you went back in 2016 and met some of your former adversaries?
Yeah, John and I were part of, 11 of us?
11, yeah.
Well, what was that
Navy,
like?
Navy, Marine, and Air Force guys.
Yeah.
And we went back and we met, there were about 20 of them, I think.
20 former North Vietnamese, now Vietnamese pilots.
Pilots.
Sure.
And we got to meet them. It was kind of strange in a way, but I mean, Colonel Lamb, the one MiG pilot, 17 pilot, as I said, he was the first one that I saw at 8 o'clock.
Mm.
He was the one that I got to talk to. There are two of, out of the six pilots, there were two of them were still alive, both 17 pilots. And one of them lived down in Saigon, or Ho Chi Minh City, I guess they call it now.
Right. Okay.
And he didn't come up there. And I learned from Colonel Lamb that that day, I learned that the first guy that we shot down died that day. He did not survive the ejection. Both the MiGs we shot, they ejected.
Right.
So we assumed that they lived. But Colonel Lamb told me that the pilot, our first kill was a real kill. The guy did not survive the ejection, and the other guy did, but he was killed in a dogfight later in the war. And the two MiG-19 pilots were also deceased. So, out of the six, only two of them were alive, and I got to meet one of them. Mm. And we sat down at the table, and we had just like we'd.
Debrief
came out of Whiskey 291,
yeah.
Came back to debrief our fight, and, you know, 43 years later, and we're remembering it the same way. And I said, well, it was 8 o'clock, and I said, my pilot, we departed the airplane and did a backflip, and he said, yeah, I know. He says, that was me. He says, I thought you were gone.
He didn't think he'd recover it?
No, he didn't. He thought
wow.
And he said, and then he looked in the mirror, and he said, oh, my God, you guys are behind me. And as I saw the missile come off, and I defeated it. So, I mean, that was, but he confirmed, I asked him that, I said, we surmised that we were supposed to fly in front of your formation going after the 19s, and you would be on R6, right? He said, yeah. And then he said that they admitted that they had screwed up, but they hadn't left enough. So I mean, it was kind of a...
Yeah. I mean, so let me ask you, these are former adversaries. I mean, theoretically, if you were foot soldiers, you could have been fighting face-to-face. Now, of course, it's a long time since then. Was it cordial, professional? Was there any, not distrust, but hidden agendas? I mean, how was that meeting a former adversary? That has to be somewhat strange, I would think.
It was very cordial, would you say, John? I mean...
There is no animosity.
No.
It's interesting, I think, the Vietnamese today... it's still a communist country, communist government, but it's a capitalist society. And the reason they're doing so well is because of capitalism, not because of communism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those former fighter pilots recognize that, even though they are beholden to the communist government, they recognize the benefits of what has happened to their country since that war. There were 30 million people in Vietnam in 1972. There are 90 million people there now. So most of the people in Vietnam have no recollection of the war, except the people we were talking to lived it.
Right.
And I thought they were very gracious, even the ones that had friends killed by American pilots.
Mm-hmm.
But we had the same thing, too. We had, there was no animosity on our part. Yeah. It was a very interesting visit. But also, I think that one of the things that impressed me is that we went out to Kep Airfield on that trip, and they shut down the base. They didn't operate any airplanes, and we couldn't go on the base. We were off the base for about an hour.
Mm-hmm.
The next year, we invited the Vietnamese in a reciprocal agreement to come to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And when they came to San Diego during the Blue Angels weekend.
Yep.
So we take 25 Vietnamese pilots out to the Blue Angels weekend at Miramar, and they walked on the tarmac, and there's the F-22, there's the F-35, there's the F-18. Mm-hmm. There's every airplane in our inventory that they can go up and touch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's the difference between a communist-controlled, very controlled government.
And we got them to be guests in the chalet of the commanding officer of the base, a nice chalet with food and drink and everything like that. I mean, they were over the moon.
Wow.
They'd never seen an air show before, I guess, because I don't think they do them over there.
I guess they don't need to recruit people into the aviation. They just tell them if that's what they're going to do.
In aviation, they'll say, you're going to be a pilot. And that's what they did. Wow. But I think part of that, too, in my opinion, too, is that, in the air war, we were fighting another airplane. It's not like you were on the ground grappling with them in hand-to-hand combat or something like that. It's a different atmosphere in that. And I think the aviators the world over. I mean, we're pretty much all the same. We're kind of have the same mindset and everything like that. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't anything personal about it.
You did your duties on
they
both
were,
sides.
And they were they were defending their country, and we were doing what we were ordered to do. And so it was there was more of a, I don't want to, this is kind of a cliche maybe, but almost like a form of chivalry where, like the knights of old where they respected. Well, look at the German pilots, and they were and met their adversaries, United States, for, and those things went well. Not so much the Japanese, but so, no, I found it a very rewarding. I almost didn't go, and Kathy made me go.
Kathy and, being your wife?
Yeah, my wife. Okay. Yeah. But she said, no,
you got to go
do it.
It's probably good closure, I would think.
Yeah, it's, I'm not sure what closure is, but it was fun.
Okay.
And to meet these people, and I think, we were treated, everywhere we went. The population, all Americans, they wanted to talk to us and everything. So,
well, they say time heals all wounds. It's a bit cliche, but certainly that has been to our benefit. I mean, gosh, the Carl Vinson just had a port call in Vietnam recently, the first carrier in a long, long time. So, we're friends with the Japanese. We're friends with the Germans. I think bygones can be bygones.
Yeah, and after we had debriefed our fight and all that stuff, and Colonel Lamb and I start talking, what about your personal life? And I said, what about you, family? He said, yeah, he's married. And of course, we're doing all this through an interpreter. We're shooting our watch down two languages through an interpreter. But he said he had three daughters. He retired as a colonel.
Okay.
And I retired as a captain, same rank.
Right.
He has three daughters. I have three daughters. I said, grandchildren? He had seven grandchildren. I have five grandchildren. We talked about that, so I laughed, and I said, We beat you in the air, Colonel. I said, but you beat us in the Grand Kansas Department. And he laughed. He thought that was so funny. And then I told him, I said, well, you know, later after our dogfight, I said, 3 months later, I said, I was shot down by a surface-to-air missile. And I said, I became a prisoner of war over in Wallow Prison there, the Hanoi Hilton, as we called it. Mm-hmm. And he hadn't noticed it, but I held up my left hand like this. And I said, and this is my souvenir from the war, if you will. And you can't see that on this microphone here, but my left thumb was amputated in prison when I was a prisoner of war. So I came back from the war a little shorthanded, so to speak. And so he looked at that, and his eyes got big. He reached out, and he took my hand in both of his hands and looked me right in the face and through the interpreter, and he, very sincere, he says, I am so sorry for the suffering you experienced in my country. Mm. I mean, just so.
Human,
you know,
to human.
Yeah.
Right? In other
human
words, human. Yeah, there's so many things we may not agree on, but you still suffered, and yeah, it was in his country, and he was just connecting with you as a human. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's awesome.
I found that kind of touching myself. Wow. Anyway, I'm sorry, I'm getting
maudlin. Well, no, we've gone deep. We went very deep. Well, but I think that's almost, I mean, I say this on every episode. We could obviously go on and on and on about the F-4, but I think we've covered pretty much everything I wanted to cover. Let me just ask you this, though. In 30 seconds, you know, they call it an elevator speech. How would you summarize the F-4? And Tiger, we'll start with you. I mean, if someone came up to you and said, I've never heard of the F-4 before, what is it?
I think McDonnell Douglas did a wonderful, McDonnell at the time, did a wonderful job designing an airplane that met specifications and exceeded those specifications. And it turned out it could do a lot more than what it was originally designed to do because it was well designed. It had robust engines. It had robust weapon systems that could be developed and improved upon. And to me, that's the secret to the airplane, I think, is that it was not a one-stop shop. It could do everything. Mm. And even though it wasn't initially designed for that. And quite frankly, the best part about that airplane were the engines, I think, because they were unbelievably solid, 3,000 hours, and I never came back single engine, once.
No kidding. There are so many military aircraft throughout history. Many of them are good aircraft. Of course, there are some poor ones too. But John Ed, would you be willing to call the F-4 Phantom II a great aircraft?
Absolutely a great aircraft. It had its faults. Mm-hmm. Almost every airplane has some kind of a fault.
Sure.
But I can't imagine an airplane that did as many things as well as it did for its era.
Mm. Yeah. Sure. And Fingers, what's your thoughts on the F-4?
Well, I think I'd place it in the iconic classification, like a B-51 Mustang or, you know, any of those like that. And for the reasons that not only did John just talk about, but here it was thrown into, it fought in a war, you know, it was not designed to do what it did. Mm-hmm. And yet every mission that it was given, it did well. It might not have been the best, but it was good enough to be, I would call it an iconic airplane.
Sure. Excellent.
It was designed to fly fast and at treetop level, carrying 24 nuclear weapons. Today, it bristles with smart bombs and guided missiles. The B-1 bomber, called the Bone by those who fly and maintain it, is the most heavily armed bomber ever built. Sleek and powerful, the Bone remains a mainstay of American air power 50 years after its first flight. Hey everyone, this is Ken Katz, call sign Primetime, and my book, The Supersonic Bone, A Development and Operational History of the B-1 Bomber, tells the true story of this magnificent airplane. In this book, you'll read stories told to me by those who were there and see lots of great photos of the Bone. Anyone with an interest in modern military aircraft will enjoy reading The Supersonic Bone, available through the usual online retailers and aviation booksellers. Pick up your copy today.
Well, I want to thank both of you gentlemen for your time this evening to come into the studio and speak about the F-4 Phantom II. It's been very interesting and informative discussion. Thank you very much. Before we let you go, however, we always end the interview with how you got your call sign, because call signs, let's face it, for us, we know that they're fun and there's some good ones out there. But for the listening audience who didn't live the lives that we led, they like to know how we got them. So John Kerr, John Ed, as you're also known, but Tiger, why don't we start with you? How did you come up with Tiger? How did someone come up with Tiger for you, more to the point?
Well, it's usually someone comes up with a call sign, especially if you do something dumb. And unfortunately, I guess, I hadn't done anything dumb yet. So I had a classmate from college that was my roommate on the ship. And we both were from Princeton. So Princeton's old Nassau. So he wanted to have the call sign Nassau. So he kind of lobbied for that. And I said, well, you know, we were the Princeton Tigers, so a Tiger would be a good one for me, I think. Well, it turns out he tried Nassau out, and the controllers didn't understand what he was saying, and they thought, are you calling yourself asshole or what? That's what it sounded like over the radio.
Sure.
So that one didn't go. So, but Tiger still stuck with me. So.
Well, Tiger's an easy one on the radio. It's got the right phonemes. Yes. All right, fair enough. And so, yeah, like you said, you never did anything sufficiently.
I didn't do anything that dumb. I did a lot of dumb things, but I got nothing that would stick as a call sign.
Nothing that would make him change it.
Yeah. Oh, dear. And now for you, Fingers, we've kind of already touched on it. I mean, you went over with 10 digits, you came back with 9, and we didn't even talk, by the way, about your, as you put it, what'd you call it, unaccompanied
shore duty.
All right. Well, so, gosh, I don't know how to broach this without making the episode another half hour longer, but I want to do justice to it. Tell us what happened that day and some highlights of your stay and how long you were there.
Okay, well, what you want is a thumbnail sketch, huh?
Wah, wah.
Okay, the quick and dirty is 3 months after Muggs and I got to MIGS, he was ordered out of the squadron, and he came back, and he took over Top Gun.
Okay. He was my CO at Top Gun.
All right. Yeah. Okay.
And when it was stood up as a squadron, right? Right. And so I got another pilot. His replacement was a guy we all knew and loved, Mike Doodoo Doyle. And Mike and I were flying together on 25th of August, 1972. Ironically, on the same mission, a MIGCAP mission.
Okay.
And ironically, in the same airplane that Muggs and I shot the MIGs down in.
Wow.
And ironically, on our 13th mission together. we just crossed the beach and going to our cap station, and we got taken under fire by, you know, several surface-to-air missile batteries. And so we, instead of fighting MIGs, we started fighting telephone poles. And successfully dodged a couple of them, and I was looking behind us at one that we had just defeated, and one went off over the cockpits, one that we didn't see, which is, I guess that's always the way it is.
Yeah.
And next thing I knew, I'm sitting in the back seat, bleeding all over myself with my hand, the shards of the canopy and shrapnel had. I had my hand up in a handhold like that, fighting the G's and operating the ECM gear down here on the console. And so I yelled at Mike. I said, "Hey, can we get to the water?" And I looked forward, and he was obviously not flying that airplane. He was kind of slumped forward, and we were about 3,000 feet or something like that, about 400 knots or something, going down. And I realized that he wasn't flying that airplane. So I reached down with my good hand, ejected us both from the airplane. Next thing I knew, I'm hanging in a chute over a rice paddy coming down. Tried to get my radios and make a radio call to our wingman, let him know that I was alive, which was important. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I couldn't reach my radios. And when I hit the windstream on the ejection, my arms just flailed like a rag doll because I was one-handed and I didn't have the curtain. So dislocated both elbows, pushed them about halfway up inside of each arm, and the people in the ground are shooting at me. I hear the bullets going by, but I'm in the chute not very long, thank God. And they were bad shots, hopefully, I guess, or both. Landed in a rice paddy. They came along, dragged me up, and stripped me down of all my gear. And then after dark that night, they took me down to the main road, turned me over to the uniform military, threw me in the back of the truck and took me to Hanoi. And I was in Wallow Prison. I was in a room for, oh, I guess it was 10 by 10, 12 by 12, something like that. You know, just a chair, a stool, and a table, and a waste can over in the corner. And they threw me on the floor and walked away. And I'd say maybe an hour or so later, they came back, jerked me up, made me sit on the stool, and the interrogator came in and started questioning me, sitting on the chair and the table. Name, rank, cylinder, and date of birth. Mm-hmm. That's all I can tell you. It's like, well, you got to tell us more. You got to tell us what ship you're from, what blah, 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 all this stuff.
Right.
And I kept saying, I can't do that. Geneva Convention, Code of Conduct, blah, blah, blah. And it went on for, you know, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes, something like that. He got up, walked out. The guard kicked me off the stool back on the floor. And that routine went on then for the next 3 days.
Oh, gosh.
Around the clock. Every few hours they'd come in on the stool, a question. It wasn't always the same interrogator. I mean, mm-hmm. they had a watch bill. I was on watch all the time. And at one point there, toward the end of there, I was a hurting puppy. And I said, please, I need medical attention. I'm hurting. My arms are starting to discolor from lack of circulation. And my hand, at the shoot down site, a kind Vietnamese lady came up, and she had a first aid kit you might carry in your car. And she tucked what was my thumb was severed partially, but she tucked it in the palm of the hand and wrapped it around and around and around to keep it from flopping around. Mm. And then the blood soaking into it. So I looked at that. I didn't know what the hell was underneath there. Mm. And so one of the interrogators at one point, when I was begging for medical attention, he said, no, you are not cooperating with us. He said, you're dying. We will let you die unless you cooperate with us. You understand? And so I got the picture. And after that session, I said, this is really internal conflict. I mean, a code of conduct. And, of course, he's telling me I'm dying, and I've got a wife and three kids at home. And, you know, of course, I don't want to die, but I want us to kind of, anyway. So I came up with a plan that next time they start asking me this, I would tell them a lie about what squadron I was with and all that stuff. And anything that I figured was of military importance, I would lie about. Mm. Next thing came in, and anyway, that seemed to satisfy him. After I started answering more questions, it wasn't anything that I had that was any value to them. It was, they just wanted to let you know that they could make you do whatever they wanted you to do. And that was true of all the tortured throughout there. And so after that, they came in, blindfolded me, and took me out through a series of gates. I'm sure it was outside the prison, to some medical hospital or something, I guess, probably the same one John McCain was treated in. And took me into a room, operating room, and strapped me down on the operating table and held me in place, and with a few of his physician's assistants, I'll call them, held me down and held my head. Surgeon came in, took off the gauze and looked at it like that, and took a scalpel and amputated my thumb.
No anesthesia.
No mayi or very poor bedside manner. And after that, they stuffed it with, you know, and wrapped it up, and then unstrapped me and took me to another room and took a couple of fluoroscopes, as you call it, of my elbows. You know, this fluoroscope is kind of like an early precursor to before x-rays. Mm-hmm. And it's just really, held them up to the light, looked at them for a few minutes, put them down, and his physician's assistant sat me in a chair against the wall and held me in place. And he came over and put his foot in my chest, took my arms and started pulling on them until they snapped back in place. wrapped him up in some rudimentary splints, blindfolded me, put me in a truck, took me back. And I spent then the next total of 30 days in isolation until mm-hmm. they caught me communicating with some other prisoners that were in cells around me. Mm-hmm. And then they put me in with a group of those guys, a big cell, about 35 or 40 of us in one of these big long cells. And I stayed with that group throughout the whole thing until we came back with the last group of prisoners in 29 March 1973.
So last in, last out.
Last in, last out. Okay. That was our plan. I mean, that right. was a rule. First in, first out.
Right.
And so, yeah, I was lucky. People say, you're crazy. How can you be lucky being a POW? I was only there 7 months. If I'd have been shot down on my first cruise in 1966 off Coral Sea, I'd have been there 7 years. So 7 years, 7 months, I'll take that trade-off any day. So
I'm sure that didn't make it easy day in and day out, especially with some of their methods to get answers, but still.
No, that was the only, which I would classify as torture, that I experienced because I got there during the holiday season. All the systematic torture and the ropes and all that stuff that the fogs had gone through was pretty much gone. There were individual cases like mine where they did it, but as a systematic thing, it stopped. So it was I was fortunate. I came home and back together and got back to flying. And
what was the disposition of your pilot?
Mike didn't make it. His remains came back 13 years after we did, and he's buried in Arlington. We buried him in Arlington. So I talked to his brother, Jack Doyle, who is also a Rio, at Fort Rio, myself, at the funeral. And Jack told me that the forensic pathologists at Hawaii, who look at all the remains when they come back, indicated that he was probably either dead when I got us out of the airplane, or he probably didn't last much longer because of the trauma to the skull and all that stuff. Because, as a Phantom, you guys, pilots, you're much more exposed than we were in the back. You're sitting there with all that canopy and everything, and, we were in the bunker back there. So I didn't take as much of the brunt of the missile like he did. So anyway, so Mike's he's in Arlington right now.
All right. Well, God bless him and his family. Yeah. So it's hard to make light and try to have fun with a conversation after a story like that. Thank you, Fingers.
No,
but what I want to touch on is that you made it flying again, and then some crass group of people decided to call you Fingers.
Yeah, the J.
It's called fighter pilots.
my call sign up till that point, and the squadron was hung on me in VF-21 when I first joined the squadron there, and my last name is Inch.
Right.
And most people pronounce it Inch, but it's Inch in German. But anyway, so it was a ENSCH. So they hung an IT on the end of it, and I was known as a inch shit. So
right.
What do you do? The
Fingers is better.
The more you fight it, the stronger it gets. So
wow.
When I took over as after I got back on flight status, after 9 months of getting put back together at Balboa Hospital, and I convinced them I could still do everything in the back seat that I needed to fly. If I'd been a pilot, I never would have gone flying because couldn't have put speed brakes out, for Christ's sake. And they gave me back flight status, and my first assignment was out Top Gun. They were going to send me that was in January of 74. I was 9 months in the hospital and got released. And the Bureau said, well, you're going to write me orders that September to go to PG school and get a master's degree.
Postgraduate school, okay.
Postgraduate school in Monterey, California.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that. But anyway, so Mugg said, well, send him out here to Top Gun, and, we can put him to work. He'll be, SLJO there. We'll give him special projects or whatever. And so I went out there, and about a week or two after I'd been there, the XO then, Jerry Sawatsky, I walked in one morning and Jerry was taking God rest his soul too. He's gone with now. Anyway, he had a box and he was taking all his personal stuff in the XO's office and packing it up. And I said, hey, Jaguar, what the hell are you doing? Where are you going? He said, I quit. I said, what? He said, yeah. He said, I can't take it anymore. He said, Jerry had just gotten married. recently. I mean, okay. And he was a NAVCAT, not a NAVCAT. He was an OCAN. He was a guy who had no college, year of college, something like that. A NAVCAT, you know, where.
Sure.
So he was trying to get his degree at going to school at night and his marriage. And then, you know, Top Gun is not, as you all know, mm-hmm. it's
pretty consuming.
It's not an 8-to-5 job. I mean, no. When you're in there preparing your lessons and flying 2 or 3 times a day and all that stuff. So Jerry got, he wanted out. So he called Muggs and said, I can't do this anymore. So he walked out, and I'm standing there flabbergasted, and you know, a little while later, Muggs came in, and I said, hey, what the hell's going on? Jerry just left, and he says, yeah. He says, you're the XO till you go to PG school. Oh, shit, okay. So I became the XO at Top Gun.
Okay.
And, of course, you know, the JOs, and I was a lieutenant commander. You know, but Top Gun in those days, right, we were kind of Navy's answer to McHale's Navy, I think. You know, 2 lieutenant commanders, a SEAL and an XO, and the rest of them a bunch of hard-charging lieutenant JOs, right. That, you know, irreverent bastards. Anyway, so they couldn't have an XO with the name of Inch yet. So they had a contest to name the new XO. Uh-huh. And there were, some of them were Hang 9 and this and that and other. They took a boat, and they came up with Fingers, and so they started calling me Fingers.
Okay.
And that stuck from then on. So anyway, it's... So well, I spent 2.5 years there because we were over at the O Club.
What happened to PG school?
Well, I'll get to that. I've been there a few months and I've come in and we were over at the O Club and sitting there with Captain Scotty Lamoureux, who was comfit at the time, and Muggs and I were sitting a beer. And he said, how do you like, I think Muggs had something to do with it, but anyway. Lamoureux says to me, he says, well, Fingers, how do you like being an excellent Top Gun? I said, oh, this is great. I'm flying, getting a couple flights a day in backseat of T-38s and A-4. And anyway, I said, oh, this is cool. And he said, well, you like that, huh? And I said, yeah, that's come to an end, though. I said, Bureau's going to send me to PG school in September. You want to go to PG school? And I said, you know, you're supposed to say, well, yeah. I said, I'd much rather be flying. He says, how would you like to be do a full tour as an XO with Top Gun? I said, well, yeah, that'd be cool, like, Captain. But I said, I don't write the orders. He said, oh, okay, well, we'll see about that. So pretty soon, day or two, I got a set of orders as excellent time.
Stay there
and then go to PG school.
Okay.
So I ended up being there. So
wow.
That was cool.
Well, golly.
It's timing.
Fingers, that is an amazing story from start to finish, and I'm sure you have more, but in the interest of those who might be sitting in their cars waiting to go into work because their commute is over and they're listening to us, I think we should probably wrap this up.
Yeah.
I want to thank both of you for your, if my math is correct here, over 65 years of combined service to this nation, including almost a year in another country in austere conditions, and over 5,000 flight hours in our subject of the day, the F-4 Phantom II. Gentlemen, this has been an honor to sit down with you and discuss. And John Ed, I'll just turn it over to you if you have any parting shots. I want to thank you for being here.
No, I'd like to thank you for what you do, though. I think it's, I've listened to some of the podcasts mm-hmm. now that after I've met you, and it's a treat. And I'd like to see this keep going.
Well, with guests like you, I think it will, because the listeners out there, if I may speak for them, a lot of them would have loved to have done what we've done. Maybe not everything you did, Fingers. You know, life gets in the way. They don't have the eyes. Something happens. And they're living vicariously through us. So thanks for sharing your story with them.
Sure.
Fingers, I'll let you wrap it up if you got any parting shots.
Well, I just like the second what he just said is what you're doing here. I've listened to a couple of them, too. And, you know, this is important. I mean, whether we like it or not, we're part of naval aviation history. Mm. And if we don't tell these stories, we don't get this out to the generations coming up, they don't learn from our successes and our mistakes. Mm. they are destined to do some of the same things too. So I think what you're doing is a wonderful thing, and it's, you know, and it's so casual. I'm having a good time here just talking, you know. It's like sitting around the Oak Club with and even have an adult.
And a refreshment.
A refreshment.
Yeah, well, I didn't bring enough, and that's probably the biggest reason we need to quit. So, excellent. Well, thank you, gentlemen, both very much, and I look forward to this episode airing. I'm sure the listeners will really enjoy it. Thank you again.
All right.
Thank you.
All right.
Cool. Holy cow, dude. So May 23rd, it was amazing to hear that shootdown story out of Fingers, right, with the section of 19s and the division of 17s. And how they basically broke turn, his section, right, broke turn into, if that's the past participle or past tense anyway, into the division, shooting down those two 17s with the winders, pretty impressive. And then how about the fact that they met up in 2016 with 20 of the former NVA pilots, and they got all the details on that bait and trap, I guess, tactic.
Right.
So I thought that was kind of cool.
I can't imagine. Of course, I've never been in a skirmish or combat like these gentlemen have, but to do that and then go later and face your former enemy. I mean, talk about reconciliation at its finest, and the fact that they were all so professional and cordial and genuinely interested in each other's families. That's just beautiful, man.
Yeah, it really was. And then, also loved how, when you guys went through the variations earlier in the first segment, you talk about the F4S with the AUG 10, right. And the smokeless motors, maneuver slats, high thrust. And, so those smokeless motors, kind of touching on that a little bit, the dirty engines, right? So with the smokeless, the smokeless motors, and thanks, sorry I couldn't be there for that discussion, dude, but what you notice out of like B-52s and some of the older jets that have engine nacelles or, you know, engines hanging off their wings, that dirt actually comes because the engine's running cold, but that's on purpose because they, a lot of them, not the J-79s for the F-4, but they would actually inject water into the engine itself to keep different components cool enough. So that they wouldn't, because they had basically material science issues, if you will, or manufacturing issues. So the cooler it ran, the less would actually be completely burned in the carbon chain, right? And just as you put very well in the interview, you'd have these this particulate that would come out the back, and it would usually have condensation nuclei and pieces of water coming out the back too. So you get kind of thick. So not only would it be black, but it would be thick black smoke. So that's the reason why they had the dirty motors. But then I think he mentioned when you go into min blower, right? Min afterburner,
right.
It was just hot enough and the fuel mixture was just such that it actually had more complete combustion and it had less dirty exhaust. So you did it well without me, dude. So bravo.
Well, every once in a while, the blind squirrel finds a nut, right? So, I don't believe the F4 carried water, but we have recorded the interview for the B-52, and the listeners will soon learn that it did. And so, that's a great explanation. And Sunshine, that was just one of many things we talked about on this episode. I mean, the creation of Top Gun, like we've already talked about, the Vietnam, both then and now, being a POW, the shoot down, the shot down, the end of dogfighting, question mark, you know, just wow. And by the way, we talked about the F4 Phantom too.
That's right. We did, didn't we? Snuck it in there at the end.
That's
that was
right.
Good. So great episode.
Well, there's a couple other hanging chads. I had mentioned the F-14's TCS television camera system. I think what I was thinking there, Sunshine, was the infrared search and track on the F-14D.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. So the TCS is not IR, right? It's just EO, electro-optical?
Correct.
Visible wavelength? Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
Nice.
And then when Fingers was talking about getting an F-4 for the Midway, he didn't really mention, but he is a Docent, I never know how to pronounce this. Docent, I guess. On the Midway.
Yeah.
So he was involved with getting the aircraft on there.
Mm-hmm. Which is pretty cool. So, and he still does it. He's still a docent today, right?
I believe so. Yes.
Yeah. So folks in San Diego visiting or living otherwise, you know, roll over there and ask for Fingers, or at least look for the gentleman in the red jacket with obviously 9 fingers.
Hang 9. That was an awful attempt.
Dude, that's so naval aviation. Oh, we're so thick skinned, or at least you got to be thick skinned. I love it. Absolutely love it. So.
Yep. Yeah. Okay, a couple others. Turkey, the country, not the person, although I'm sure he would love to, is still flying the F-4, according to my research. And Sunshine, what did you find to school me on the F-35 costing? Because they were taking a guess at it, but I think they underestimated quite a bit.
Yeah, they did. And then, dude, the thing is, Sorry, I got to go with the test pilot answer again. But when you figure in costs, you have non-recurring costs, which would be the R&D, the research and development.
Right.
And that is going to kind of get spread like peanut butter across the entire inventory. Mm. Now, so if you decrease the inventory, then that spread like peanut butter starts to build up more on each plane. So what will happen is you have this movie number based on how many assets are actually purchased, or I should say manufactured. So anyway, all that aside, I'd say a good rule of thumb is 85 million. Does that sound about right?
That sounds about right. And that's what, close to triple an F-18 and probably about double a Super Hornet. So that's a lot of money, but it's supposedly a very capable aircraft. And to believe it was Griffin's earlier question, we definitely need to get that one featured here on the Fighter Pilot Podcast. Your old buddy, who was it? Skosh. He would have been a great candidate, having flown all of them, but maybe we can find someone else to get on the show, just because we haven't done a second visit yet from anybody, but maybe we could bring Skosh back.
And good old Skosh, actually, he's going places in the Air Force, dude. So he got sucked up to what we call a data mask position. So basically a super secret squirrel thing. So he's out of pocket right now. But Rost, if you're listening, you're out there, and I'm going to come find you the interview. So
excellent.
There you go.
All right, a couple more things here. Fingers snuck in, and I didn't get a chance to explain it. SLJO, which we're already going to have to be in the explicit category on this show, Sunshine.
Yeah.
So let me simply say that is the shitty little jobs officer. It's what everybody gets when they're new. You know, you got to do all the crappy stuff nobody else likes. And then a NAVCAD is a Naval Aviation Cadet. Now, I didn't warn you I was going to ask you. Do you remember what that is?
So that program, I think, was established, no kidding, back in 1935, and it was there to entice civilians and enlisted folk to become pilots. So I think the entry requirements, if you will, you needed an associate's degree or 2 years of college completed, and then you had 18 months of training. And during that time, if you couldn't be married, nor could you get married during that training. And after that, once you got your training complete, you got your wings, you have a 3-year commitment. And that program lasted all the way up until, I think it was October of 93. So was that 93 minus 35? It was about 58 years that program was around. So it did a lot of good for the Navy.
Yeah. And as I recall, you might have already said this, you didn't have to have a degree necessarily like you normally would for the Naval Academy or ROTC. They can work that in afterwards. But yeah, it's not available anymore. I think, though, I still know, who is it? Proton was a NAVCAD, maybe? Anyway, I've got some buddies that are still hanging on from that old era. All right.
Yeah. Sorry, just to interrupt you. One of my best skippers ever. So Dennis, call sign Laser Lazar.
Oh, yeah.
He was a NAVCAD. Yeah. And so Laser was an air crewman in helicopters and then went through the NAVCAD program, became a pilot, and was an epic F-18 pilot and skipper. Just a all around great, great American. I use that a lot, but he really was. Yeah. So
that's okay. Well, proof that you don't have to have a bachelor's degree to be a great pilot, but that is still pretty much the requirement these days, as we've talked about before. Oh, dude. Well, I think that's pretty much everything on that.
Patreon. Should we, let's hit on Patreon.
Okay.
What's going on there?
Well, so we have some new division leads. We have Richard Meredith, Will Hales, and Chris Wanacott, and new strike leads, Danny Crivello and Chris Murphy. Now, Sunshine, as I alluded on the previous episode, 51, we will be restructuring Patreon effective August 1st. And the reason is the same reason that even though there are cars on the road that are successful and good looking, the manufacturers still change them up every couple of years. And so we're going to do the same thing. We're going to consolidate down to fewer tiers. We're going to delete the three lowest tiers, and we're going to offer more content and more recurring content. And it's just a way for us to just kind of clean up house a little bit, tighten things up, and also offer more value to the patrons who so generously support us. So we're really looking forward to the restructuring.
Yeah, giving a nice good facelift, I would say. Absolutely.
For sure. All right, Sunshine. Well, this has been one or two, I suppose, very long episodes. What else is there this week?
Hey, well, I want to backtrack just a tad. That is that when you guys mentioned the last F-4 to crash, that QF-4 out of Point Magoo. I actually knew that guy, unfortunately.
Oh.
He was an instructor of mine in Kingsville, So he left behind a wife and, I believe, two daughters. So his name was Commander Mike, call sign Storm Norm. And just so full of life, man. Just one of those. It's always tragic, but it's especially tragic for the family he left behind. And he was just such a dynamic, good personality. So unfortunately, he lost his life in the coming into the break, if you will, there, April 20th of 2002. So my heart goes out to his family.
Indeed. Well, golly, I hate to end on a down note. Tell me something else.
Oh, sorry. Well, I'll tell you what was epic. Last thing is an F4, ladies and gentlemen, F4 Phantom, reported by our two great interviewers there, or interviewees, excuse me, went up to 98,000 feet.
That's right.
98,000 feet. So, dude, I'm pretty sure that's an astronaut qual, right?
That's right. He gets the little extra special wings.
Yeah,
very
exactly.
Cool. Well, I know the F4 Phantom 2 episode will be among our leading topics here on the aircraft series. And Sunshine, once in a while, we should probably still look out for other things to talk about. I've got a buddy who was in charge of the SEER school. Everyone remembers that's the Survival, Ooh, Evasion, Resistance, yeah. and Escape. And another mm-hmm. thing is, everyone has been asking for, there's three different people by name our listeners have been asking for. One okay. is Chip Burke. And he flew pretty much everything. He was a Top Gun instructor. He did an exchange tour and flew the F-22. He flew the F-35. And he hangs out with the Echelon Front guys. He's been on Jocko's podcast. And so I think there's a good chance we're going to get him here on the Fighter Pilot Podcast.
Awesome.
So once in a while, we'll take a break from the aircraft series. And I can't even tell you what's coming up next, folks, because I don't know. Maybe it'll be Chip. Maybe it'll be a different aircraft. But I'm sure it'll be good.
It will. Flexibility is the key to air power.
That's right. Well, as always, we'd like to remind everyone that the views expressed in this presentation are the personal views of the hosts and our guests and do not necessarily represent the position of the Department of Defense or its components. So until next time, what do you say, Sunshine?
Let's get out of here.
Let's do it. See ya.
You've been listening to the Fighter Pilot Podcast, brought to you by BVR Productions. Got a question for the show? Send an email to questions@fighterpilotpodcast.com or leave a message on our listener line, 877-MACH-101. That's 877-622-4101. Be sure to check out our website at fighterpilotpodcast.com. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. For exclusive Fighter Pilot Podcast content, check out our Patreon page. Please like, follow, and subscribe to the show. And don't forget, share us with your network. Thanks for listening.
Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post 9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.